Welcome to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, President of the Ohio Christian Alliance. Stay tuned for an analysis and conversation about the issues that matter most to you and your family. Here now with this week's edition of News in Focus is Chris Long.
And good afternoon and welcome to this edition of News in Focus. We're glad that you've joined us. Well, we're going to talk about the state budget on this program, and we're going to have an expert that's going to join us to break down the numbers of the state biennium budget. Governor DeWine's budget and his first administration is being wrangled with as we speak in what's called the conference committee. That is, after the Ohio House passes its budget, its version of the budget, then it goes to the Senate, and then they pass their version of the budget, and then the discrepancies or differences between the two have to be worked out in what's called a conference committee. And we're going to talk about that and how there is, of course, wrangling back and forth, give and take, as it were, negotiations that go on high level at the Ohio State House between the two chambers on what stays in, what goes out, and what compromises are made. Here to discuss it with us is Greg Lawson. He is a senior research fellow at the Buckeye Institute. The Buckeye Institute is a conservative think tank here in the state of Ohio. They provide research analysis on much legislation at the Ohio State House. They're a valuable resource. We like to consider them to be the Heritage Foundation of Ohio. They do similar type work. They're a conservative group, and of course, they look at the budget hawks as well to weigh in on overspending. And I know that means a lot to all of us who are watching our bottom lines, and we expect government to do the same. Well, without any further ado, here's Greg Lawson. Greg, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Chris, for having me on. It's always good to be with you.
Well, you know, each time I talk to you, my friend, I always learn something new, and that's you're in a high order there with a lot of people that I trust and rely on. Bill Fetter is one of them. Every time I talk to Bill, I learn something new about history, and each time I talk to you, I learn more about public policy, especially when it comes to numbers crunching and the analysis of how this is all going to be projected of the cost and expenditures of our state budget over the next 2 years. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the budget. What is the bill number for the budget?
It's House Bill 166.
House Bill 166. And so the House passed it about 6 weeks ago, and then the Senate got it, and then they passed their version. And there's a lot in this budget. Now, each time this happens, it's a little bit of a dog and pony show of all the groups that come down. I call it the soup line before the finance committees, of everybody really singing for their song, you know, their lunch. And so every group that is getting money in some kind of state program comes down and sings a song, get the violins out. Don't cut our program. We need this funding. We do the following. You know, there's going to be dire consequences if we don't get this. There's a lot of that goes on. Explain to our listeners what that's like.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, just so your listeners understand, this bill is 3,217 pages long, at least the current version of it that was passed by the Senate. So it's a really big bill, and you got to read it to learn what's in it. Hopefully you read as much of it before it gets passed, right? We know how that goes with other policy questions. But you're absolutely right, Chris. A budget, when you see the folks come in and testify to both chambers, it is always a very long line of people. And look, there's a lot of needs that are out there here in the state of Ohio, and there's a lot of things that people are doing, groups that are doing good work. But the problem is that there are finite resources. Now, right now, we're actually in a real upturn for Ohio. We're in an upturn because tax revenues are running ahead of what budget projections were when this whole process started earlier this year. And so expectations are that as a combination of more tax revenue coming in and some areas where the spending is coming in below what they were projecting, we're going to have more money at hand. And what that has meant is that if you really look at this budget, it is a perfect budget for legislators. It got over 80 votes in the House out of 99 seats. I actually forget the exact total, but it was over 80, which is a very, very high percentage. Most budgets don't get that kind of broad bipartisan support. Usually it's much more partisan, quite frankly. And the Senate, when it passed the budget last week, passed it 33-0. There was not a single no vote on this budget.
Wow.
I think that's the first time since I've been watching, and this is probably my seventh or eighth budget that I've watched real closely over the last 20 years, and I've never seen a budget be unanimous. I've heard that it's happened before, so I don't think it's singularly unique, but it is certainly a rarity. And the only reason that is able to happen is because of those revenue projections and things, because what that allows legislators to do is make everybody happy, which is what they would prefer to do all the time. We're concerned, though, at the Buckeye Institute. You mentioned it at the top there, that we like to be kind of the budget hawks. We want government to do what government needs to do. There are things that government absolutely must do and should do. But this budget is really, really big, and it's a lot bigger than even the current budget that we're getting ready to finish up. So the end of the current fiscal year is actually Sunday, this coming Sunday. So the new budget has to hit on July. It will start. So this bill that has yet to be passed and signed by Governor DeWine will actually be effective on July 1st, so Monday, July 1st.
By law, it has to be done by then. Is that right?
Correct. That is correct. It has to be done so that the new appropriations start on July 1st. And it's $140 billion total budget when you look at all of the different line items, which, and we'll talk about this hopefully in a minute, but that's a lot higher number than probably what a lot of your listeners are seeing in some of the headlines that they're reading or internet stories that they're seeing. They're probably hearing and seeing that this is a $69 billion two-year budget, but that is not really fully accurate. That is just the general revenue fund budget, which is a significant portion of the budget, but is less than half of the overall size of this thing. So I think it's really important for listeners to be aware of just what the size of this is and how much of tax dollars this is really taking up. But, you know, I don't envision it's going to get much smaller by the time the conference committee gets done. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me if it gets even a little bit higher because of these kind of rosy forecasts that are out there. There's not really an incentive for the legislators to cut back, but we've been making the case that they need to consider it because there's some reasons to have some concern about the economy. The economy is still doing relatively well. We don't want to be naysayers or doom and gloom kind of folks. But there's some turbulence out there. You know, there's trade wars going on. Ohio's GDP is always less than has historically in the last 50 years been below the national average. So there's just a lot of reasons to have concern. And we're saying, let's control the rate of growth. I mean, there are some things we should just totally cut and not do at all. But you can actually save literally billions of dollars by restraining the growth of spending without even cutting, actually doing a real, what I would call a true cut. I mean, most people think of a cut as being, I spend less today than I spent yesterday. But even if you didn't do that, you just cut again, that rate of growth, you could save billions of dollars. But we're not seeing that. That's something that is very troubling to us because when a recession hits, which will happen at some point, the more you've spent today, the harder it is to get the budget balanced when you have to, and there's a constitutional mandate, a state constitutional mandate, that this is a balanced budget. So we can't go and do all the debt stuff that the feds do. We don't print the money with the Federal Reserve like the feds do. And if we have to cut, and you have to cut in the middle of a fiscal year, you're going from using a scalpel and making strategic cuts to maybe having to use a meat cleaver, which is painful for everybody.
We're talking with Greg Lawson. He's Senior Research Fellow at the Buckeye Institute. We're talking about the state biennium budget, which is being in conference committee right now. The differences between the House and the Senate are being wrangled in the committee, and we'll get word later in this week as to whether they've come up with an agreement or not. They are constitutionally bound to get this done, and the governor to sign it by Sunday night at midnight, June 30th. Whether they'll meet that deadline or not remains to be seen. Greg, what are we hearing out of the committee? They just began today. Yesterday was the preliminaries of Ohio Budget Office. Basically, was giving them the Budget Office was giving them projections of income before they went into negotiations. What are we hearing so far out of the committee?
Well, the top line discussion is that there's a lot of agreement across both chambers. So I think that there's something like 400 or so differences in policy and in some cases different amounts of spending between what the House passed and what the Senate passed. So what I think they've already managed to probably do is two-thirds of that has probably been resolved, actually, as of right now, because a lot of that is stuff that's pretty easy. But there are some big-ticket items here that are far more there's bigger differences between the chambers. And in this case, it's because, again, of the, I mentioned before, the sort of overwhelming bipartisan support that each chamber had for their respective versions of the budget. This is not as much right now a Republican-Democrat thing as it is a House-Senate kind of thing. So, for example, there are some discussions about how much to expand school choice. The Senate did more of that than the House did, and so there's discussions about that. There's discussions about graduation requirements that the Senate put into the budget and the House did not. There's discussions about the academic distress commissions, like in Youngstown and East Cleveland, some of the takeovers that have happened here in the state. And so there's ongoing discussion about that. And there's also a series of healthcare policy items that are being discussed. How do you deal with surprise billing from healthcare providers? Some certain reforms to Medicaid, the nature of how we do price transparency so that people who are consuming health services have an actual idea of what they're spending, something that doesn't really happen right now, unfortunately, because of how complicated and how, quite frankly, opaque healthcare spending is here in Ohio and the country at large. And also, there are some substantial differences on tax policy. Both chambers did a tax cut. The Senate version was a deeper tax cut. The House closed several what we call tax loopholes and tax expenditures. They also did a deeper reduction on a small business tax deduction that has been in existence for a while here. The Senate restored part of that, not all of it, but part of it. So these are the kind of issues that are definitely creating some differences between the chambers. There's actually one other thing, too, is there's a good provision that the Senate has put in to try to reduce regulations here in Ohio, unneeded, I should say, regulations, not regulations dedicated to making sure that public safety is assured, but the kind of regulations that just make life more difficult for people to earn a living here in the state. And so the Senate,
let's
the leadership.
All right, let's hold it up there because I have a couple of questions for you. First of all, small business tax cut, that actually I was in favor of. I know our auditor, Keith Faber, when he was in the Senate, he actually passed that. And it is a tax cut for small business, which is the primary engine for the economy of job hiring in the state of Ohio. You want to encourage that sector. For so long, we penalize that sector. First of all, it's so burdensome. I don't need to tell you from the Buckeye Institute because you folks talk about the layer upon layer of the regulations upon small business that makes it really difficult and arduous for small business to even get started in the state of Ohio. We should do everything we can to incentivize and encourage them, and that tax cut was doing it. I would hate to see that taken away, and I know that the House version did. I'd like to see that the Senate version bringing it back. I think, again, for small businesses, it was imperative that you keep that in. Also, the testing reduction amendment. Now, this was our listeners have been watching. We've been monitoring House Bill 239, a testing reduction or elimination in American government history. We oppose that bill, House Bill 239. But a Senate amendment, as we said, might make its way into the budget. Well, this one did, and I actually got on the phone, talked with Senator Lou Terhar, the author of the amendment. He said, Chris, it doesn't touch American government history. We're taking the 7 graduation tests, and we're removing 5 and reducing them to 2. But the end of course exam for American government history is retained. So we went neutral on the amendment. We were worried that they were going to take the elements of 239, House Bill 239, and put it in the budget bill. That did not happen to our knowledge. We had you reviewed that, of course. We also had some other folks that reviewed it, Sarah Fowler on the state school board, from what she can understand in the amendment's language, that it does retain, doesn't touch what is known as the Founding of American Documents curriculum, formerly Senate Bill 165, passed 7 years ago, signed by Governor John Kasich, which is assuring that constitutional studies in the Ohio classroom from the 8th through the 12th grade with an end-of-course exam. But it doesn't, so they're taking the 7 graduation tests, reducing them to 2, hoping that that would make those folks in the teachers union happy that some of the testing is being reduced in the classroom. We're neutral on it because it doesn't affect the American government history. Your thoughts on that amendment staying in?
Yeah, we actually liked what the Senate did there and agree. I talked to Senator Turhar as well as several of the other members that it does not touch the founding documents curriculum and the test. We would not like it if it did for the same reasons that you very well articulated for a long period of time here. There's some other aspects to it where it gives some flexibility for some of the students that sometimes have a hard time with things like the algebra and the bad test takers, the folks who maybe know stuff but they don't perform real well on tests. There's alternative mechanisms for them to be able to get graduated that are in here, and we think that in general that's better. And I'll tell you the other reason we were supportive of this concept and testified to the effect before. The Senate subcommittee and Education Committee, actually, is because there are alternative proposals that have been floating around out there, including from the Department of Education, and we had some concerns that it might water down some of the standards and create problems for students who are trying to get gainfully employed once they get out of school or getting into the next phase of whatever they may be doing in terms of post-secondary type education. And we thought that this was a more rigorous proposal. And given the nature of the competition economically that we face here in the world today, doing anything that lets that down, we thought was problematic. So we generally liked it. We didn't think that it touched any of the things that needed to stay for, again, making sure that we have the right kind of citizens being brought up here, which is indispensably important. So we didn't want that to happen, but we do not believe the language does that. I will say, however, there's a lot of pushback on this from some teachers' unions groups. And
why would they be doing that?
Oh, I think a lot of it is that they don't like where this came from. They didn't necessarily have as big of a seat at the table as they think was their due, and they don't like that. So they're trying to say that we need to pull it out and have separate conversations about this outside of the budget.
And I'll tell you why they want that, because they want that full credit hour of American government history, and they're not getting it. That's what we put in Senate Bill 165. I've said to everyone, they want that golden apple of that one full credit hour. They want it diminished, and the only way they can achieve that is by attacking it directly, and that's what House Bill 239 does. And this amendment does not do that, and it actually speaks to their issue that they say on the surface is test reduction, this graduation test reduction. Well, this amendment does that, and yet they're still whining about it. Greg, this is where we need to really call them out. And you know, that's why I think this is just a bunch of baloney with the teachers union. We know what they're after. They don't want our kids learning that founding America, the American history and American government. There are liberal teachers that go into teaching, not all, but there are some, and they don't want that to be a requirement in the Ohio classroom. Well, this is what we did to get that through, and we're going to fight it. We're going to fight it to keep it in, folks, and so stay tuned on that. Well, Greg, we got a few minutes left. Let's talk about the disparity of those two numbers, because the general revenue, the papers are saying, a $69 billion budget. Biennium budget. But you're saying the real number is $140 billion. Explain that to our listeners.
Yeah. So general revenue taxes are basically what you think of. That top number that the press always talks about is coming out of what's called the General Revenue Fund, which is a fund that's created and that is funded through most of the big state taxes. So when you think of the state taxes, you think of the personal income tax at the state level and the state sales tax. There's a business tax called the commercial activities tax. All of those and a number of others flow into the general revenue fund. But there are a lot of other smaller taxes, different fees, and there's a bunch of federal money. Now, some federal money flows into the general revenue fund and some doesn't. So this is where it gets really complicated. But what really is the price? So the general revenue fund is again, I think that's why the press probably quotes it is. That's what most people think of as the state tax dollars, and people don't really think about all the money that's coming in from all these other sources. And I think that's a disservice to taxpayers. Because federal money might flow to some dedicated fund that's not considered the general revenue fund, it's still a tax dollar. And it's still coming out of somebody's pocket, and it's coming out of your pocket and my pocket.
Yes.
And everybody else who's listening's pocket. So whether it's coming from Washington and getting recirculated through the state government from a Washington bureaucracy, whether it's coming from the state lottery fund, for example, all the money that comes from that they use to fund public education, that's not part of the $69 billion number. That's about $1 billion there, and that's non-general revenue funds. So the other thing that happens is they
What about the sales tax on alcohol sales?
I believe a good chunk of that falls into the general revenue fund. I believe a lot of that does, but there's some that get siphoned off for like administering and managing that process, the liquor control and stuff that happens there. And I'll tell you, here's an interesting story. You can pull stuff off of general revenue and say that it's not general revenue, and then it doesn't show up in that top line number that the press talks about. Now, it is in the budget document. So if you're a budget person like me and you're going through the spreadsheet that go through every line item of the budget, this stuff is there. But if you're the average person and you're hoping to learn what's going on through your regular media, you're not going to know that. You're not going to go to the Legislative Service Commission website and draw down this number and look at all of those non-GRF line items. And I'll tell you, like last budget, there was a complicated thing that was going on with Medicaid and federal money that used to go into the general fund. They pulled off of the general fund and stuck it in another line item. Well, that doesn't count as part of that $69 billion. You can do all kinds of things with the funds and moving stuff around and making it be on general revenues or not be on general revenues. And we call it a shadow budget. I actually just had an op-ed in the Columbus Dispatch on this very
That's
subject.
That's right. I was going to refer to that. And folks getting on your email list, tell us how they can do that.
Yeah. Check out our website, first of all, BuckeyeInstitute.org, and we will be happy to get – there's a thing there for you to sign up to the email list, and you can do that anytime, and we'll send all this stuff out there to make sure people get educated on this. Because this is extremely important. Again, that's BuckeyeInstitute.org. And I bet that we're probably one of the few, if maybe the only group in the state that's even raising this issue. But again, it's important for people to realize just how broad, even if you support the spending and the priorities that are in the budget, you should at least know where it's all coming from. And so we just wanted to alert people to the fact that the budget is much larger than you are being led to believe. And here's what the true scope of that is. And, the more people know about this, the more they can hold legislators accountable and say, well, just because you're pulling this off and putting $3 billion over here versus keeping it on general revenue funds, that doesn't mean it's not being spent. It's still being spent. It's still real dollars.
Yes.
And that's the key thing.
Well, Greg, thank you so much. A lot of great information. Again, Greg Lawson, Senior Research Fellow at the Buckeye Institute right here in the state of Ohio. Check them out at their website, BuckeyeInstitute.org, and sign up to their email list right on the top of the page. You'll see join the email list, real easy, to sign up and receive their information. In fact, the op-ed that was in the Columbus Dispatch on Sunday that Greg just referred to about the shadow budget, all that information is there at their website, again, at BuckeyeInstitute.org. Greg, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir. And again, if you missed any of today's program, you can log on to our website at ohioca.org and hear it in its entirety. Thanks for listening. God bless. We'll see you next week.
You have been listening to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, president of the Ohio Christian Alliance. To learn more about the issues that matter most to you and your family, visit online at ohioca.org. That's ohioca.org. Thank you for listening. This program is sponsored by the Ohio Christian Alliance of Akron, Ohio.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity.
And the soldiers who stormed the beaches of Normandy and the Allied liberation of Europe. On D-Day, all those warriors set out on their mission. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt led our nation in prayer.
The D-Day Prayer Project is an effort to add FDR's D-Day prayer in its entirety at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. This wonderful historical presidential prayer will be a lasting tribute to our World War II veterans. If you'd like to make a contribution towards the effort of adding this prayer to the memorial, go to the website at ddayprayerproject.org. That's ddayprayerproject.org.
Who's looking out for seniors today? It's not the AARP. AARP worked overtime to help pass Obamacare, the legislation that cut over $700 billion from Medicare. And AARP supports the death tax, which can rob families of over half their savings due to the death of a loved one. Seniors know that AARP would rather make millions peddling insurance products than support the policies that actually help America's elderly. That's why America's seniors count on the 60 Plus Association. For more than 20 years, 60 Plus has been fighting for the seniors that AARP has left behind. 60 Plus fought against Obamacare and continues to fight every day for its repeal in Washington. And 60 Plus is the leading national organization working to repeal the death tax once and for all, so that families can pass down their businesses and farms to the next generation, not the IRS. Stand up for your values. Join 60 Plus today. Visit 60plus.org or call 703-807-2070. This message paid for and authorized by the 60 Plus Association.
Welcome to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, President of the Ohio Christian Alliance. Stay tuned for an analysis and conversation about the issues that matter most to you and your family. Here now with this week's edition of News in Focus is Chris Long.
And good afternoon and welcome to this edition of News in Focus. We're going to look into education issues as it pertains to discussion on the State Board of Education here in Ohio of the social-emotional learning standards. That's right, that liberal jargon is a proposal that actually passed the State Board of Education, but not without a fight by some of our conservative members. In just a minute, we're going to be going to one of those members to talk about what happened on the State School Board of Education in debate this month. But as we do, we want to give you an action item, of course. Last week, we talked about House Bill 239, which is in the Primary and Secondary Education Committee, chaired by Lou Blessing. That piece of legislation would do away with American government and history standards and testing in Ohio schools. It'd actually do away with the end-of-course exam, all but killing what we know as the Founding of American Documents curriculum. That's the fantastic legislation and curriculum that we got enacted into law 7 years ago. It took us 10 years to get that through the Ohio General Assembly and signed by Governor Kasich. And for the last 7 years, our young people have been learning about the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist and Anti-Federalist Papers, the Northwest Ordinance, and the Ohio Constitution in the Ohio classroom from the 8th through the 12th grade with an end-of-course exam requirement, which guarantees that the teachers will have to, and the school districts and the schools will have to spend time teaching the subject matter because it's in the graduation test. Well, here comes the liberal Teachers Association with their union members, and they two years ago, attempted a proposal on the State Board of Education, which we defeated. Many of you made phone calls and emails. Thank you for that, and God bless you. But now, here it comes by way of legislation, and it is has a Republican sponsor, Gail Manning, and a Democratic sponsor in the Primary and Secondary Education Committee in the House, and we proposed opposition testimony last week. Well, this week it did not have a hearing, so that was a bit of good news. But keep the calls and phone calls going, the letters and phone calls going, folks, because it's making a difference. And where you can obtain that information is the Ohio Christian Alliance website. Go to ohioca.org, and right at the top of the website, you'll see the links for the committee and for the opponent testimony that we presented before the committee. And so those are your talking points, basically telling the committee, vote no on HB 239. We don't want it. We want to continue American government and history standards as they are currently in the Ohio classroom. So save the Founding of American Documents curriculum.
by voting no on House Bill 239. With that, we're going to turn to our guest this hour, and that is State Board of Education member Kirsten Hill from Amherst, Ohio. She serves in the 2nd District of the State Board of Education, and she was putting up a valiant fight against social emotional learning standards. We're going to find out just what that is, but it's really not good, and there's a lot of concerns with it. Unfortunately, it did pass the State Board of Education by an affirmative vote, but not without a fight. Kirsten, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be with you, Chris.
Well, thank you for serving on the State School Board. I know a lot of folks in your district were thrilled to see you win election in November. And, of course, you've just been there a matter of months, but you're headlong into a battle already when it comes to autonomy of the individual and, of course, parental rights. And this has all the makings of something of which the state is taking more of the role of nanny state or parental role rather than the parents overseeing the education of their child. Explain.
Yeah, that's for sure. I am new in the education realm. Just started my term January 1st this year, and my background is in business. Though I do have two children and a family, so I've known what it's about to try to get your children supposedly educated at the schools. But what you've said so far is on the mark. The social-emotional learning standards that passed last week, essentially, it's hard to discern, but it's a sleight of hand moving the locus of the responsibility over children's basically values, attitudes, and beliefs from the home to the school.
Well, that's right.
Yeah,
and looking at some of these talking points of the concerns about social-emotional learning standards, and we'll get to where maybe this came from because it seems like it came out of nowhere, but some of the concerns are no expert consensus on the definition of social-emotional learning. I always like when it's, tongue-in-cheek, when it's ambiguous in its definition. I mean, people are like, what is that? And parents are going to say, what is that? What social-emotional learning standards? I want my kids to learn the 3 R's, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic. I don't want them, what's this other business? I need these kids to be able to function by way of reading and math and science. I mean, what's this other business? So tell us, in your opinion, what you've heard on the State Board of Education, what is social-emotional learning standard by those promoting it?
Yes, Castle, which is basically the godfather of this, and that stands for Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning. They are out of Chicago, and they have kind of broken it down into sort of some broad categories, self-awareness, and these are right off of the standards, self-management, social awareness, relationship skills, and then responsible decision making. Those are how they describe them. But essentially, in everyday terms for the family, what we're talking about are the values, attitudes, beliefs, dispositions, behaviors of the child. So that's. the technical terms that I described first, the self-awareness, self-management, these standards are all drawn up in a big chart that are now available on this Ohio Department of Education website, and it'll give examples in the grade, various grade sections of kindergarten to second grade, third to fifth, middle grades, and high school, I can give some examples of what those are. Identify. So they're tasking the student to be sort of an observer of themselves. Wanting to get. I don't want to get too much into the weeds of it, but I could tell myself that this was going to get. We're getting way far away from what we consider, the basics of education, of learning. Now we're going to get into how the student is feeling.
Oh, yeah. This is fraught with all kinds of problems just on its face. And, you know, and I know people would sit back and say, well, look, we know that, you know, a lot of the students coming from single-parent homes or broken homes and all kinds of, you know, problems, especially in the inner cities. Certainly, those are troubled students coming into the classroom. It takes an extra skill by a teacher to keep their focus, their attention, to get them moving towards their personal goals for the students. And that's part of the skill of teaching. And, you know, we would like to commend our teachers. I mean, I think teaching is a worthy profession and it's a calling. And, you know, I think back of the great teachers I've had in my life along the way who had great input. So a teacher has a lot of tasks in front of him or her in the classroom, no doubt. And so if you do see a student that's troubled with some things that may come from home, not that you want to address that directly with them, because that's not always the answer, but to kind of redirect for them to give them something positive to stand on to keep them, you know, moving in the direction of what they need to do to achieve their academic goals at the level of which they can achieve them. And, of course, you know, and there's a lot of teachers that do just that, and it's a juggling act. But this business is putting a template of, okay, social-emotional learning standards. Everybody's got a problem. No, you don't start from that premise, okay? Not everybody's got a problem. Not everybody's, you know, having these kinds of issues. But, oh, wait, yeah, you have no idea. Well, look, you know, that's part of the gift of teaching and the administration and those kinds of things is to help each student to achieve their goals for the academic success that they need for on their pathway to graduation. This business here doesn't do it. Yet, in fact, to me, this is like a distraction. There's no answer here. Whoever came up with this is, you know, again, here we go. It's really liberal jargon here. Social-emotional learning standards. I'm like, wait a second. How do you learn math, science, English lit, history with that? You know, you don't.
If I can interject, Chris, I think it's helpful to look at some of the examples of how this is being implemented in schools. So in Cleveland, they've been doing social emotional learning type items for about 10 years now. And there was a profile in an article just in the last couple days here of visiting a school in, I think it might have been the LeBron James-sponsored school in the Akron area. The school's called I Promise or something like that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, there's a big ado about that opening last year. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. So they describe an activity that is in the realm of this social-emotional learning. And essentially, when the students arrive at the school, they will spend the first hour of their school day focused in this area. Everything else aside, this is more important in that first hour of school to discuss the feelings of the students. As you say, there is a place and there is a need. And since time immemorial, teachers have been developing positive and useful relationships with their students.
That's right.
On a one-on-one basis as they need it. But this is doing this in statewide standards is a prescription that everybody needs it, and we need to prescribe it across the board. And that's, the next question is, how do you measure whether it worked? You know,
well,
and then
that's right.
And then we get into the discussion of how do you measure this?
Well, and then not only that, here we go by the state collecting data on students,
right?
And then social-emotional learning infused into academics resulting in psychological manipulative standards, not rigorous or clear like math and English. These are some of the concerns of the bullet points of those who have been looking at this and saying, hey, we got a problem here. I agree with their concerns. Your thoughts?
Yes. In fact, there's a Code of Federal Regulations, Chapter 34, 98.4, something like that, that discusses this basically delving into privacy and schools extracting information that is not in the realm of what they should be looking at. So it could turn into students being submitted to psychiatric or psychological examinations, testing, and then could be even treatment. And is it, you know, are these teachers, are they equipped to be psychologists and psychiatrists? I mean, just doing the examination or testing, it's notorious that that kind of trying to measure those items is difficult, and there's a lot of pitfalls. There's a lot of it relies on a student's self-reporting. Well, there's one case that's mentioned, and I must mention one resource if somebody, if any of your readers want to dig into this more. I would say the best place to go is to the Pioneer Institute. There was a white paper titled Social Emotional Learning, K-12 Education as New Age Nanny State, and it's written by Dr. Karen Ephraim and Jane Robbins. And you may recognize the name Jane Robbins. She was in the fight against the Common Core, and this is all part of the Common Core ends. That paper is written in March 2019.
We'll put this on the website and make it available.
Yes.
And I have that printed out here of the materials you sent. I want to get real quick to the proposal, because you actually put up a fight on this on the state school board. This was a proposal of some of the social emotional learning standards to be adopted by the state school board for the Department of Education to implement into the school districts, if I got that correct. You put together a proposed amendment. Now, you did garner some support for this, and I'd like to read briefly the amendment that you proposed that would have dealt with the concerns on this. Item 19, Social Emotional Learning Standards Resolution. On June 11th, Board of Education voting agenda. Be it further resolved, the Ohio Board of Education, the Ohio Department of Education, will not develop any form of assessment to measure or gauge students' progress in learning or mastering the social-emotional learning standards. Be it further resolved, this SEL standards will not be factored into any form of measurement used to evaluate a teacher. Be it further resolved, the Ohio Department of Education will not require or recommend that a student's mastery of the SEL standards be measured through any local form or formative or summative assessment. Be it further resolved, no student shall be required as part of any program or activity related to social-emotional learning standards to submit to any form of psychiatric, psychological examination, testing, or treatment without prior written consent of the student's parent or guardian, God bless you for writing this, in which the purpose is to elicit information about the student's attitudes, habits, traits, beliefs, or feelings. Now, folks, this is a good amendment. It's really sticking up for our parental rights, our individual rights as taxpayers who pay for school districts. Unfortunately, what was the fate of this proposal, Kirsten?
Yes. In fact, this is the formal resolution, and I need to give credit to Melanie Elsie, because she really helped to put this all into words here. In May, at the way these...
But this was voted down.
Yes, the resolutions go through the committee first. So
right,
at the committee level, I attempted to stop this, or I attempted to amend the resolution to approve it. And I simply said, you know, no assessment, collection of students' social-emotional learning traits by the state, you know, by the state level. I'm addressing the state level. Local schools are supposed to have local control. So if they wanted to adopt something, that's not addressed here. This is totally focused on what the state would do. But my amendment in the committee did not pass, and then the resolution for adopting the standards went to the June 11th meeting, which was last week, and there were five other members of the current 17-member board who did vote with me to adopt my amendment on the standards resolution, and it but it failed. There were it was ended up being six of us for this amendment and 11 people against it. And then we went forward and voted on the whole, or no, it was seven people for it. Nick Owens had switched spots. And then when the standard came up for resolution, we also voted against the whole standards, and that vote was 11-6.
Well, I thank you for putting up this proposal. So let's go through the, if we shall, those who voted for this amendment, which we would favor, which concerns parental rights. So that would be Kirsten Hill, that would be Sarah Fowler, that would be Nick Owens and John Hagan. Who else?
Jenny Kilgore out of the Cincinnati area.
Okay.
And Mike Toll.
And Mike Toll.
And Lisa Woods, if you, I'm not sure if you said, she did
no.
also vote for this amendment.
Okay, very good. So those were members that stood for parental rights, concerns over the overreach of the state, and the rest of these members, and some of them we have to, fair disclosure, they were part of the teachers union, either currently or at one time. They're there at the behest of the teachers union. They voted against this amendment, which would have upheld parental rights and restrictions on the state to do these kinds of assessments, psychological and psychiatric assessments of your child without written permission by the parent. And this, unfortunately, this proposal that Kirsten, you put together and the others supported, the other six supported, was turned down. So where does that leave us now that the so-called social-emotional learning standards proposal was adopted by the State Board of Education? Now what happens?
Well, what I'm telling people now is to sort of keep an eye out on a local level. You know, I'm trying to sound the alarm at the state level. But what I would suggest to your listeners is keep a close eye on to your newspaper and what kind of activities are happening in your local schools. Or if you're a parent, if you see something about climate survey, and a lot of those will be automatically, your children will be asked to take these surveys. Even just taking these surveys can be damaging to children, in fact. So I would, sound the alarm and let me know if you find out. We know that the Olentangy schools had such a survey and asked very private information from the child that it reveals information about the families then. So it's not just the child's information that becomes public, but it could be your family.
Who's looking out for seniors today? It's not the AARP. AARP worked overtime to help pass Obamacare, the legislation that cut over $700 billion from Medicare. And AARP supports the death tax, which can rob families of over half their savings due to the death of a loved one. Seniors know that AARP would rather make millions peddling insurance products than support the policies that actually help America's elderly. That's why America's seniors count on the 60 Plus Association. For more than 20 years, 60 Plus has been fighting for the seniors that AARP has left behind. 60 Plus fought against Obamacare and continues to fight every day for its repeal in Washington. And 60 Plus is the leading national organization working to repeal the death tax once and for all so that families can pass down their businesses and farms to the next generation, not the IRS. Stand up for your values. Join 60 Plus today. Visit 60plus.org or call 703-807-2070. This message paid for and authorized by the 60 Plus Association.
Well, we're talking with Kirsten Hill. She is the State Board of Education member from District 2 and from the Amherst area. And she is currently serving on the State School Board. She was elected last November in the elections for the State Board of Education. Kirsten, we really thank you for your service as a conservative serving on the State Board of Education and, of course, watching out for these kinds of things that are an overreach by government and education that would be a violation of parental rights and watching out for, you know, our educational choices as well on the State Board of Education. Now, so the proposal passed, it went to the Department of Education now, obviously,
yes.
And the superintendent. So they're going to start implementation then?
What will happen is right now it's voluntary for local districts to start implementing social emotional learning standards. It's voluntary, but from the 5-year plan language that was adopted by the board last year, by the state board last year, I would suspect that there will be assessment and measurement, and then down the line, possible collection of data from local districts by the state. They deny that they will do this right now, but because my amendment didn't pass, and the other members are approving it, and they're all about data, I have my concerns that that's what we're looking at, is a mandatory participation at some point in time.
Well, folks, that's why elections matter, and those who serve us on the State Board of Education, these are elected positions. In fact, you can go to the Ohio Christian Alliance website, and the link on the bottom side of the left-hand page of the State School Board to contact your State School Board members. But also, right on the top of the page, House Bill 239, we have an opportunity to defeat this bill. We need you to get calls and emails into that committee. Again, to save the Founding of American Documents curriculum, the American Government History Standards, so our children can learn the Constitution, continue to learn the Constitution in the Ohio classroom. Well, Kirsten, thanks for being my guest today. God bless you, and thank you for your service on the State Board of Education.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much. And, of course, if you've missed any of this program, go to our website. You can hear it in its entirety at ohioca.org. Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, president of the Ohio Christian Alliance. To learn more about the issues that matter most to you and your family, visit online at ohioca.org. That's ohioca.org. Thank you for listening. This program is sponsored by the Ohio Christian Alliance of Akron, Ohio.